Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Once again, today we have one new show for you and one archive. In the second part of the program, the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Catherine Greer. She is the author of a book entitled Pets in America, A History, which takes a look at pet keeping in this country and how it developed over a period of time, going back sometime actually before, certainly before World War I. A lot of the features of modern pet ownership were in place, and she says it says some interesting things about how we felt about families and about raising children. So that's what you'll hear in Hour 2, and you can call in. Hour number 1 here, we go to the Focus Archives for a program we first broadcast in August of last year. As you listen, do keep in mind, in this first hour, we'll not take calls. In the first hour of the show today, our guest is Michael Kimmelman. He is the chief art critic of the New York Times. He's also a contributor to the New York Review of Books. His book, Portraits, Talking with Artists at the Met, the Modern, the Louvre, and Elsewhere, was named a notable book of the year by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book. It's just out now. It's titled The Accidental Masterpiece on the Art of Life and Vice Versa, and it is published by the Penguin Press. And it's a book that takes on some very large questions about art, including what is it all about, what is it for, why do people make art, why do we like to look at it, and why do we like to collect it? And he offers some very interesting answers to some of those questions and invites people to think about that, think about the role of art in their lives. And we will do that in this part of the show as we talk with Michael Kimmelman. Mr. Kimmelman, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
It's my pleasure.
There's so much here. It's a little book, and yet there's a lot here. And one thing I do really want to say at the beginning is I think that the book is it's a very accessible book. And so I wouldn't want anyone to think that somehow they had to already know about art or have some experience with art history or art contemporary or classic to get something out of the book, because I think it's really anyone, I think, could enjoy reading it. I certainly enjoy it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Thank you. And it's, you know, it's a book that's written very much for the general reader. In fact, it's really written as a kind of as a literary book, which whose subject happens to be art in a way. It's certainly not meant to be an art textbook. And I think that it used to be that great writers loved to write about art, you know, and they wrote in the spirit of the amateur, you know, Tolstoy and Proust and so forth. But art often has now become the field of specialists. And I just wanted to find a way to write about art that I loved and talk about it in a way people would find accessible.
Yeah. Well, maybe I would ask you to talk a little bit about how it is you became interested in writing in art and in writing about art. Certainly, as a journalist, you could have done other kinds of things. What was it that attracted you to being a journalist, first of all, and then second to writing about the art world?
Well, I kind of fell into my job. It was a lucky fall, but I hadn't really intended to be an art critic for the Times. I grew up in the city, in New York City, and had been a rather serious pianist when I was young. So I was interested in culture, and I used to like to take girls to museums because that was always a good date for someone who wanted to seem like a very serious young man. But I wasn't a practicing artist. What happened is that when I went to school, I went to college and studied history, and then wanted to pursue a kind of interest in social history, cultural history, so then went to graduate school in art history, really with the idea of becoming an academic historian with a stress on culture. But I found that partly because of the way art history was taught and at that time, with very much an interest in sort of theory and economic and social history, that I wasn't actually learning how to look at things. Meanwhile, on the side, I'd been making a little bit of spare cash, writing some freelance articles, mostly doing music criticism because of my background in music. And out of the blue, I was offered a job on a newspaper writing about music. That job led to another job doing the same thing, and finally I landed at the Times, incredibly, first writing about music, and then was asked, since I was in fact trained as an art historian, whether I wanted to write about art. So by this very bizarre, circuitous route, I ended up as an art critic at the New York Times.
Yeah. one of the, as a way of starting so into some of the issues that you deal with, and I'm not sure what possesses me to start at this point, but I guess I'm interested in talking a little bit about a man that you write about in the book. The man here that you write might arguably be the most famous artist on the face of the earth. And when I say his name, a lot of people will say, who? The man I'm talking about is Bob Ross.
That's right.
And certainly some people will know who Bob Ross was. He has passed. But for a long time, he was the host of an extremely popular program that aired on public television stations. It aired on ours and a lot of others. And in fact, although Bob is gone, Bob probably will live forever somewhere. There will be on television somewhere. He'll be showing people how to paint. And that's what it was. It was an instructional kind of program. He only did landscapes. And I'm sure that a lot of people would look at his paintings and say, well, that's not very good. But that the point of it was that he was saying to people, he was giving them permission to pick up a brush and paint, and essentially saying to them that you can do this if you want to, which seems to be a great, you know, to be a great thing, really, to give permission to people to do that. But I guess that what it comes down to is that there may be some fundamental drive that people have to do art. And
right. That
the reason more people don't is simply because they somehow think, well, I don't know how, or you have to have training, or only special people can do it.
Right.
And that's probably not the case.
Well, I think what you say is exactly right. I was struck by Bob Ross for many reasons. Like other people, you know, I'd occasionally catch his show, and there he was, this kind of bearded, bushy-haired guy with this incredibly narcotic voice, and yet the show was hypnotic. You know, you'd want to watch him paint these very treacly landscapes.
Oh, yeah.
And he was preaching a kind of, a therapeutic view of art, which on the face of it can sound rather shallow. But I remember listening to a radio program one day and hearing a little segment about some students of Ross's, that is, people who'd gone through the Ross program to learn the technique, and a little girl who'd done a painting, and she wanted to take it to her mother in the hospital. And it reminded me how much Ross belonged to a tradition, really, of amateurism, of art as something that is not done really just because you want to be the greatest artist, but because there's something in art that is transformative, that can change the rest of our lives. And I had found this in my own life. You know, I'd found that looking at art had given me a new perspective on the world, had opened up my eyes to ways of living. You know, to the idea that beauty is, you know, not something fixed, but that we can invent it and reinvent it for ourselves. And so I got interested in Ross and in amateurism in general. And, you know, I one day was fishing through a shoebox and discovered some old snapshots that my parents had taken of me when we were on a trip to the Soviet Union, of all places. And they were sort of weird photographs, just bad enough to be interesting. And so I wanted to write a chapter that included Ross and Winston Churchill, who was, of course, an avid amateur painter, and how amateurism, reflects a general impulse we all have to want to find some creative part of ourselves, but also to the fact that art can occasionally happen turn up in the most unexpected places.
Mm. So you do think that there may well be a very kind of fundamental impulse in all of us or almost all of us to make art?
Oh, I think so. If not to make art, then to make something creative out of our lives. And occasionally art can be instructive about how to do that, even if we don't become painters ourselves. I said before I played the piano, and I must say that I have found that even if I did not end up becoming a pianist, that many of the lessons I learned about playing the piano, about pouring oneself into something, about how to work, how to partition one's time, all this kind of stuff can enrich the rest of your life. And I think that at the heart, that's what drove me to want to write this book, was the feeling that there was some reason why more people supposedly go to museums than go to ball games. I mean, they're obviously looking for something, but on some level, I think people may feel alienated because art is held up as something that is obscure or elitist or requires a certain body of knowledge which is accessible only to specialists. And I wanted to basically say, in a same way that you're suggesting really here about Bob Ross, that, you know, part of it is just opening your eyes. And just trying.
And then, and I do, I guess I do think, as I said, that maybe one of the things that he did that made him successful, or that caused people really to find him appealing, was that people might have had this impulse, they might have wanted to do it and found some variety of reasons why they couldn't. And what he was doing in that way he had was saying to the people who were watching, sure you can. Go, you know, go ahead here, and I can tell you a couple things. I can show you some basic stuff. It's not that hard. It can be a lot of fun. Go ahead and try it. And for some reason, I guess that probably some variety of reasons we find for telling ourselves no, we can't.
Well, that's true. And Ross, of course, I mean, I don't think Ross thought that he was painting great pictures or teaching people to paint great pictures. And by the way, he said that, you know, most people, an overwhelming majority, just watched the show to watch him. They weren't actually taking his advice, but that there was something rather, well, if not, you know, narcotic about watching him, there was also something very comforting about the process of watching someone else do it. But, you know, he spoke, as did other people, about this idea of art being something that can enrich your life in all these other ways. That if you put yourself into this, if you escape into this world, you'll find ways in which you can be creative in other aspects of your life. Now, you know, Ross actually belongs to this wonderful tradition, which is really what I wanted to talk about here. It's this kind of amateur tradition in American culture. And I came across a book while I was researching this by a man named Charles Cook. It was called Playing the Piano for Pleasure. It was written in 1941. Cook was an old New Yorker writer, and he wrote these kind of funny Talk of the Town pieces about places in the city with weird names and oddball characters. But he wrote this book because he'd taken up the piano, and he had felt that he wanted to instruct other people about how he had thrown himself into practicing. And it was interesting that at that time, in the 40s, you still had this idea that hard work was essential to the amateur endeavor. So Cook's book is a lot about, you know, spending X number of minutes and X number of hours, and if you do this, we'll all add up to over the course of 10 years to, you know, to turn you into someone who can actually play a simple Mozart sonata. Hmm. But by the time we get to Ross, you know, in the post-war era and an era of convenience and when we expect things to be done for us, he didn't really preach that it was hard work. I mean, basically, he was teaching that, you know, he could turn you into a happy person, if not a great painter, in 28 minutes. Mm.
There is something, I have watched the show myself, and I have to admit that there is something that is very seductive about it. I'm not exactly sure what, although I myself, I'm a complete sucker for any program that shows people making something. I'll watch somebody build a piece of furniture. I'll watch him do a painting. I'll even like to watch the guys build motorcycles.
Right.
Something. Well, I don't know what it is, but something about it, to me, appeals a great deal.
I think that's true. You know, a lot of this book is about my going out and watching other people do just that. I mean, I went out to Utah to watch Matthew Barney, a contemporary artist, make part of a film called Cremaster 2 in the middle of the Bonneville Salt Flats in the middle of the winter. And that was kind of extraordinary. I ended up almost dying, actually, out there in the flats. But I wanted to see, you know, essentially his process at work. And I spent a half a year watching Philip Perlstein do what he does. He paints nudes with these kind of funny props and objects that he collects in his house, all sorts of crazy little toys and ancient artifacts and things. And I spent a half year, basically following his routine. I wanted to, as you say, I wanted to watch other people do things that were creative. And I wanted to get out of the museum and gallery culture to essentially turn the book into a journey for myself, a physical journey, but also a kind of journey of the mind for me. And I think the journey, the pilgrimage aspect of art is an important one, this idea of trying to make an effort to understand it, and that effort itself can be a creative act.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Michael Kimmelman. He's the chief art critic for the New York Times and also contributed to the New York Review of Books. And you will find some of these questions that we're talking about here this morning discussed in some greater detail in his new book. It's titled The Accidental Masterpiece on the Art of Life and Vice Versa. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Penguin Press. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Also toll-free 800-222-9455. Here, let me ask a question. And again, this is an awfully big question, but and here it is. What is it that sets apart a piece of art that is just mundane? We'll pick on poor Bob. We'll put one of his paintings up against something by an artist that, by consensus, is considered to be an important artist who has done important work. And it's certainly not necessarily about technique, and it's not about level of technical achievement. It's got to be about something else. But what exactly, I'm not sure. What really makes the difference between something that is not good and something that is great?
Right. Well, that is a small question, isn't it? Well, you know, I mean, there are many ways of answering it, and I'll first begin by saying that as I said earlier, you know, I think one of the large lessons to be learned about art is that keeping your eyes open is a very difficult thing to do, because one feels that, as you say, there is some answer to something out there, and you need the answer, you need the crib notes, otherwise you're really not able to do this yourself, and I have not discovered that to be true. I've discovered that just having your eyes open and trying to see what's in front of you, which is not easy, can provide the answers you're looking for. Because, and this is really the straighter answer to your question, I think what's happened with modern art is that basically what art is whatever you decide it is. And while that's a very unhappy answer for a lot of people, people dislike that. It sounds weaselly and vague. Art has exploded in all sorts of directions that make it very difficult to apply the old standards to art. In other words, the old standards being a certain degree of technical achievement in draftsmanship, in handling of paint, in carving or whatever, because it's no longer confined to certain materials. It need not even be a physical thing. I mean, conceptualism in the 20th century, the whole legacy of Duchamp and Warhol, which many people loathe, nonetheless has opened up art to the idea that it can be simply a thought, an idea, a way of being. I myself find some of that very beautiful and again, open onto issues that are worth thinking about for the rest of our lives. I mean, I write a chapter here about a guy named Ray Johnson who essentially turned his life and his suicide into a work of art. And I think that sort of thing can be disturbing for people because, as I said, you know, they want to know that specifically why Bonnard is a much greater painter than Bob Ross. The answer is that he is, and for reasons that basically everyone can agree on. Those are that Bonnard's works are far more complex. They touch emotions which Bob Ross doesn't even begin to get at. They also happen to be more skillful. They're inventive in ways that had not been seen before. Their ambitions are far larger. But there isn't, unfortunately, any longer an answer to exactly what is art and what isn't. And I think the result of that has been to allow certain people to say, well, the only way you can tell is to trust the experts. Somebody's got to decide what is art and what isn't, and so it rests with the art world experts. And I think that has created a situation in which there's this feeling of insider and outsider, and I wanted to break some of that down.
Hmm. If you look back in time and in history and look at the way that people reacted to art, was that not always the case, or was there a time when people trusted their own judgment and their own reactions more than people do now?
Well, I think it is always true, of course, that there were people who were especially interested in art and who were expert at it and who spoke most eloquently about it. But I do think that when the ambitions for painting were generally agreed on, that those people who went to look at, you know, the, one of the salons in Paris in the 18th century or early 19th century would understand, there would be a general understanding of what was considered revolutionary, what was considered good, because there was an agreement on what were the technical challenges and so forth. I think that began to explode in the 19th century and certainly in the 20th century, to the point at which it became hard to think of what was potentially not art. I mean, after a guy, you know, literally cans excrement and calls it a sculpture, or in the case of Eve Klein, an artist who held an exhibition in an empty gallery and declared it art, you know, what wasn't art? I mean, an empty room, a can of excrement? I mean, you know, I think this basically exploded the whole idea that there was anything that was not art, and that's become the problem for modern art. But I think it's created an alienation in the minds of many people towards art, when in fact much of this work, I'm not necessarily saying those two particular examples, but much of this work actually has real and direct, even simple meaning for us. You know, it's very beautiful, this idea that the way we live our lives on a daily basis might itself be conceived of as a work of art, that we might try to make our own daily lives more artful. That's at the heart of this whole idea of conceptualism. And I think if we can get back to some of those issues, we can begin to relate to and understand some of this rather crazy art a little better. Mm.
We have a caller. Would welcome others. The caller is in Belgium. Line not the country, but the town nearby here. Line number four. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yeah, this is the other guy in Belgium.
Oh, good. Good. Good morning. Welcome.
Yes. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I was thinking about, okay, the creative endeavor, the need to be creative. Mm. You have people like different actors, different musicians, mm-hmm. who are very successful, and yet they dabble kind of in art, you know, mm-hmm. Like, Sinatra and Gene Hackman.
Absolutely, that's right.
Bob Dylan.
Right.
And Bob Dylan's paintings, they look like it could have been done by a six-year-old.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because in that chapter about Bob Ross about amateur snapshots, I talk a little bit about the paint-by-numbers craze in the 50s. And as you remember, there was that was a time when painting was very fashionable. Amateur painting was very fashionable with Eisenhower was painting. You know, he was
yes.
said to be painting in the White House. And,
yes.
you know, and Henry Fonda and Claudette Colbert, all these people were painting. Yeah. It was an idea of leisure time, that painting was sort of sophisticated, but easy. And it was an alternative. It was still this point, I think, at which Americans suddenly had new amounts of leisure time. They wanted to fill them with something, and they felt that it was useful to fill it with something creative. It couldn't just be lying around like couch potatoes and watching, you know, the nascent version of television. And so painting became this passing fad in a weird way, as was paint by numbers. But there was also something, I think, rather instructive about that paint-by-numbers craze, because, you know, it too itself reflected, I think, an idea about America, you know, this idea of sort of staying within the lines, trying to find some creative thing, but staying within the lines, not sort of exceeding, going out of bounds. It was a very 50s idea. Anyway, perhaps that's not where you were going with your question.
Yeah, not really. I was just... thinking about how different people who are very successful in other things, they somehow get into painting. And it's not that they're going to make a lot of money out of it.
Right. Well, I mean...
You know, it's just that they are somehow driven to do that. They just
exactly.
find some kind of release from it, even though, like Gene Hackman, he'll do another film or Dylan will do another song or do another album or something. And but still, you know, or McCartney or I don't know who else.
Sure. You know, I said that I was a pianist, and a few years ago I wrote an article about entering the Van Cliburn amateur competition in Texas. And it was a very remarkable experience because here you had, just as you're saying, all of these people, many of whom were successful. I mean, many of whom were just ordinary people. I mean, you had scientists and flight attendants and interior decorators and mothers and court reporters and actors. You know, there was a former Miss Minnesota in it.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and it was... and we'd all sort of taken ourselves to Fort Worth, Texas, basically for the chance to play, you know, for in the first round anyway, if you didn't get past that, for 10 minutes before a bunch of strangers. And I thought that was extremely moving, you know, that having some cultural outlets, having some thing in your life, some creative endeavor, even if you yourself were creative in some other way, but something that you did just for the love of it, you know, the original meaning of amateurism.
Yeah, or just because of curiosity.
And that too,
you know,
yeah.
Can I do that?
Right.
No.
And so all these people, you know, they all took themselves to Fort Worth, Texas for this opportunity. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. And I think that's true in all creative endeavors. It's something that we need in our lives. But I also think that those creative endeavors do help us understand better how to make the rest of our lives richer and more creative, too.
Okay. Okay. Good show.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We have a couple of people here who are standing by, and maybe I'll just take long enough to introduce again our guest, Michael Kimmelman. He is the chief art critic for The New York Times, also contributor to The New York Review of Books, and is the author of a new book that looks at questions, very big and basic questions like why do people make art and why do they like to look at it? Why do they go to museums? Why do they collect? And the title of the book is The Accidental Masterpiece on the Art of Life and Vice Versa. And it's published by the Penguin Press. I have a couple of callers here. The next is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the program, and I think that your guest is making a real valuable contribution to what art could be in our society.
Thank you.
It's real valuable to me. I know, like, the last time I was out in New York City, I was out there painting the top of the arena out there, and just going from... doing that mundane work to going over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the MoMA, the Guggenheim,
right,
was just uplifting, you know, like the juxtaposition of those two things was, I know, it was helped make my life a little more meaningful at the time.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if I could ask you specifically, I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Abstraction in the 20th Century? Total Risk, Freedom to... Mark Rosenthal wrote it.
Sure, yeah. It was a part of a catalog for a show that was at the Guggenheim.
Right.
That's right.
And I wonder if you, how you evaluate that as it being sophisticated or relatively...
Well, Mark's a smart guy, and that was an interesting show. That was a big, ambitious attempt to sum up the whole history of abstraction.
Uh-huh.
It was a beautiful-looking show. You know, that's one of those subjects that that's going to make everybody have a different opinion about whether you do it the way they would do it or not. But I learned a lot from that show. I thought it was quite interesting. And you know, abstraction is one of the really difficult subjects still. It's so interesting to me that you know, almost 100 years, really 100 years after the invention of pure abstraction, but you know, almost 100 years after people started just doing all white canvases and things, so that's still just about as radical a thing as people can imagine from a work of art. I think that's part of abstraction's power, actually, that it remains somehow really difficult for us to absorb.
Actually, that was going to be my second question. I was wondering if you thought that, like, Kazimir Malevich still had some resonance in our modern society, or could, and I guess you do think that, yes?
Absolutely. When you're talking about an all-white canvas, I do very much. I think we want from art, you know, to have some ability to challenge us and to make us feel even uneasy. And to raise these questions, as we've been talking about already, you know, what is art, what is not, and, you know, how much is skill a part of it, and how much is it technical skill and all that kind of stuff that I think comes up when people stare at an all-white canvas. There was a play on Broadway I may have toured as well called, I think it was called Art, and the whole plot of it was that a guy buys an all-white canvas like a Malevich, and then the question is, how could that possibly be art? And I think that's amazing that almost 100 years later we could still be having this conversation.
All right, well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for the call. And to another caller here, this is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you doing? Yeah. I'm glad to talk to you because I read your stuff extensively in the New York Times and in the New York Review of Books.
Thank you.
I've really appreciated your work over the years.
Thanks.
This is, Mike, more like a, in keeping with your, this sort of like definition of art is anything is art. In the Hindu religion world, maybe not so much the religion itself, but people that have spoke about it over the years, there's sort of a saying that to define God is to limit him or it.
Mm-hmm.
And art's, the definition of art has sort of become that, I think, in that if you define it, you limit it. So then, thusly, art is not just subjective, you know, the observer's definition of it, but it's actually not definable at all.
Yeah.
So in a way, sort of picked up on this really old idea that the Hindus carried around for a couple thousand years.
I like that. Thank you. That's very interesting.
Well, the reason I say that is because I have a doctorate in art history, but and I was a studio painter for years.
Uh-huh.
And when I went in, left studio, and went into art history, and specialized in a catacomb painting in Rome, I couldn't believe how mechanical and mechanistic everything was in this field, and how you had to be so heavily read and had to, you sort of forgot what the actual work was about and became real technical about it, more like you were stripping it of its structure and then reassembling it with your with words. And I just wanted to say that I really appreciate your work because you bring sort of a humanism to your writing, and I really, really want to thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
But I wanted to throw that Hindu thing in because over the years people have always asked me, well, you're so smart, you have this PhD, what's art? And I'm like, well,
yeah, exactly.
Not that easy.
It's a very good point you raise, and I also think that art has changed over the years. I mean, and this is the part that I think people can understand but maybe don't always keep in the front of their minds. You know, that meant for most centuries, people didn't make what we now consider art to be art. They had some purpose, some religious purpose, funerary purpose, or whatever. And we have now come to designate it art. And, of course, there's a whole evolving approach that we now have towards things like folk art or so-called outsider art, things in which we can find extraordinary beauty, aesthetic, emotional satisfaction.
Yeah.
And those things used to be excluded as art. And I'm not saying, I mean, obviously, I make my job as my living as a critic, I don't think absolutely everything is art, but I do think that the trying to limit it by definition gets us into pretty deep water.
Yeah, I think I think because of modernism, you know, where, like you said earlier, how performance art and all those things in the 60s and 70s and 50s, and where people were just thinking something, this one, that the individual you mentioned who had this whole body of work and then killed himself, and that was like his piece.
Mm.
And in a way, that's understandable. I mean, there is a context for that. Like, it's sort of like a street play versus a play on Broadway. And, you know, you can play all these games with definition, but I still think that it is such it's a larger field. It's a much bigger field. And I think people, you're right about the individual who looks at it and sort of an educational part. Like, I try to tell people, well, look at things, you know, it's the whole thing about looking. You were very, very right when you said it's really about looking at something differently.
It's very hard to do.
And most people people artificially constrain themselves. That's
right,
understandable. Education or, well, that's not art, or, you know, if it's not Elvis painting, I'm being really sarcastic here, but I really agree with your point, and I think I'm just really looking forward to your book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Well, this, you know, I've been thinking about the fact that from time to time on the program, I've had the opportunity to talk with some poets, and a number of years back, I was talking with a poet named Mark Doty. And we're talking about poetry and his work, and he read a particular poem. And the thing that I remember about it was this particular poem, that one of the images was inspired by his having gone to the fish market and seeing the fish laid out on the ice there. And it was actually the way I couldn't possibly recreate it, but the way that it appears in this poem, it's this fabulous image of the shapes of the fish and how beautifully silvery they are and the way that they're fanned out there on the ice, and it was really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I said to him something like, well, you know, I've been to the fish store, okay? But obviously, you saw something that I didn't, which gets me to this idea of something that maybe makes artists different, or in a way in which they're different, is it has something to do with the way they see things, the way they look at the world, and that it's not that the rest of us couldn't, but that we don't.
And I think they help us open our eyes to the world. I mean, I was interested. I read a chapter about Chardin, French painter, and Wayne Thiebaud, the American, both of whom have made a living of painting sort of everyday, ordinary things. You know, Chardin basically spent half a century doing nothing except painting what was 4 feet in front of his nose. You know, he painted basically the same bunch of saucepans and dead rabbits and so forth. And Thiebaud has, you know, painted gumball machines and deli counters and ordinary things. And I think there are those artists like, you know, Picasso and David and others who paint great heroic subjects and are trying to lift us up through that. But there are also these artists, you know, who celebrate the ordinary things. They kind of counsel patience and calm. And I think they open our eyes to just what you're saying, you know, that fish lying there on the fish counter. And we should be grateful for them. I mean, I must say, after looking at Thiebaud's pictures, I've definitely tended to approach, you know, my deli counter with a great deal more reverence than I did before.
Well, the other thing that sort of occurs to me and triggered by your interchange with the last caller is that, and perhaps it's because we have been, if we've been taught something about art, we have somehow been taught the idea that there is supposed to be meaning, that it's supposed to mean something, and that perhaps makes us suspicious of an artwork that's merely beautiful.
Right. Well, and meaning is something that we can, meaning is not a fixed thing. I mean, the artist may have had some intent. Over time, we may lose total touch with whatever that artist's intent was. We don't really know what was going on with the cave painters, but we can look at some of those pictures and be moved by them. So there may have been one meaning. There may have been new meanings. Meanings change over time. I mean, I think one of the definitions of a great artist is that the artist's work seems to change over time as we look at it, that it has new meanings every time we think about it again. You know, that's true of Matisse or Picasso. I mean, I think it's because there are new things that we can apply from the world we are in to this work, and so the work seems fresh each time.
We have about 10 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Michael Kimmelman. He's chief art critic at the New York Times. And the book that we're talking about, if you'd like to read it, it's titled The Accidental Masterpiece on the Art of Life and Vice Versa. And it's published by the Penguin Press. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One thing I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about while we still have time is collecting. And certainly I have known some collectors over the years. I think mostly the people that I've known have been record collectors, and it's a disease. It's clear, and I think actually any kind of collecting may well be a kind of a disease. I'm not sure if people who collect art, it's the same. I suspect maybe it is. But you write about a fellow here that you met, a man who was a dentist, who apparently has since passed away, but for a long time, his collecting passion was light bulbs. He had an enormous collection of light bulbs.
That's right. Yeah, there's a man named Hugh Francis Hicks. I found him. He lived in a house not far from the Walters Art Gallery in Baltimore. And, you know, he told me that when he was a baby in the crib, he'd been bored one day. His mother thought he was bored, so she gave him a light bulb to play with. And he survived that brush with danger and developed this obsession. And over time, he collected 75,000 light bulbs. It was, as you can imagine, the largest collection of light bulbs in the world. And he put it in his basement. He called it the Museum of Incandescent Lighting. And his daughter said that he would literally leave patients with peroxide still bubbling in their mouths if someone showed up so he could go turn on the lights. And I thought there's something very beautiful about his obsession, as there is often about collecting, which itself can be a kind of art. and which reminded me of the whole history of museums, which grew out of what used to be called wonder cabinets. You know, these collections of the most, whatever was the most extreme, the largest, the smallest, the most exotic. You know, so you'd have Seychelles nuts and fossils and elk's hooves and also paintings. And that was really the root of museums, was in this idea of wonderment. So it was wonderful when Hicks said to me that you know, people come to his museum and gasp in wonderment. I thought that was perfectly right. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to think about, you know, why people collect and what they're doing and how it relates to making art itself. And I think there is a connection, at least with real collecting that's done for out of obsession and love and not just out of for investment's sake.
Mm-hmm. Well, that just, to me, though, does raise the issue of when it gets to be totally about obsession, when it's no, and it's almost no longer about the things in and of themselves anymore. It's about the act of collecting.
Well, I think 75,000 light bulbs qualifies as an obsession.
Yeah, well, I think so.
He crossed the border somewhere after 1,000, and then he kept going. But the I think the obsession is not so much in numbers, of course. It's in the passion with which one does this. And I have to say that he made me think of a friend of mine who I include in the book, too, a guy named Alex, because it made me realize that we all, in our way, try to collect, or at least to define ourselves through those things which we surround ourselves with. Alex was a writer who lived in a small apartment here in New York City, and he had books. He lined his whole apartment with books, and he was the first person I ever knew who threw out books. He just didn't have room, and so he got rid of them. I'd never seen anything like that, and he did it because those books had lost meaning to him. So he wanted to, and he had no space. So if he bought a book that was so thick, and he wanted to save it, he had to get rid of one or two books that were just as thick. And I came to realize over time that in a quiet way, Alex, like Dr. Hicks, my dentist in Baltimore, was both obsessive and also really creating a kind of a work of art of a sort. It was a kind of self-portrait, and Alex was tending that garden of his library. Even though it was a very modest thing, the kind of thing we all may do in one way or another in our lives, but that he turned this very mundane thing of, you know, getting books and putting them on his shelf into a kind of artistic endeavor. And I thought that was rather beautiful. And after Alex died, I was struck that I thought actually I was the only person who was particularly noticing this, because Alex didn't make a point of it. Mm. And after he died, I was struck when I saw his father, and lived in London, that his father had moved the entire library and even the shelves to his house there as a kind of memory of Alex.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that's left. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't mean to get on a soapbox. I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of collecting and other kinds of art experiences, just because I was struck when you were talking about art as being something that brings us meaning and that we bring meaning to. You used a lot of visual imagery, opening our eyes and artists seeing things in ways that we don't. And as a person with a disability, actually it's not a visual disability, but I am constantly sort of struck when people speak of art as though it were only a visual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of wanted to call in just to say that there are many artists who don't see it all. And sometimes I feel like the use of the visual imagery is a little bit exclusionary.
Uh-huh. Thank you for that. I hadn't thought of it that way, although, of course, I'd been talking earlier about conceptualism as being really ideas that were in the mind that were not visual at all. They were sort of ways of being. And I must say, as a musician, I certainly understand that art is something that can be oral, and it can be... it doesn't have to be even tangible.
Well, again, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Let's go to someone else. Pena, the locale here for caller on line number two.
Hello. My comment. I just want to go back and touch on the Greeks and the Romans and their classicism and the Renaissance, where art became a business. People paid for their... pictures, shall we say, their portraits and their still lives. And suddenly they invented the camera. And this changed the art world forever. Today we have all kinds of colored photographs, pictures, and photographs can contain many of the elements of art, such as composition and so on. And that's my main comment. I graduated from the U of I Art School in 1955. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm sure that you would agree with the idea that photography was an art.
Oh, of course. And, I mean, it's absolutely true that art was changed by the invention of photography, that is, painting and sculpture were, because the need to reproduce things precisely was now taken up by some other mechanism. But I think it was also extremely liberating for painting and sculpture. And vice versa, I mean, photography and painting have had this incredible creative relationship. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about photographs, even amateur snapshots of my own, because I love them deeply.
Well, if someone called real quick, we could probably get the call in. Otherwise, we'll have a couple of minutes here left with Michael Kimmelman. Let me ask you something that, might seem a little peripheral, but I think that it's connected, and that is art education. And I think about the fact that in recent years there has been so much concern, particularly about what happens in public schools, its failure to teach the basics, and over time, this is not necessarily a recent phenomenon, but over time, a lot of those things that some people would call frills have been pared away, and I'm sure that art education, art and music and things like that, those are the things that have been pared away. And I guess I wonder how would you answer the question, what do we lose if particularly in school settings we don't take some opportunity to give children an opportunity to look at art, to think about it, to talk about it, and to make it?
I mean, you can guess where I stand on an issue like this, and especially having a small child myself. I mean, To see it as a kind of frill is to completely misunderstand, I don't mean you, but I mean I think those people who regard this as something that can be gotten rid of, is to completely misunderstand the way in which learning about these things trains the mind to do all sorts of other things in life, almost everything else, ways of thinking, ways of being creative in one's job. There's almost no aspect of life that is not enhanced by having had some encounter with the arts, hands-on encounter. And I think, you know, it's basically it's a tragedy for the country, and it has nothing to do with the fact that fewer people will feel comfortable in museums or listen to classical music. It has to do really with the health of our nation and its ambition. It's large ambition for itself, and I think that probably the effects of it will only be felt more and more over time. And I hope that I hope before it's too late, we can recover something of what really makes us a great nation, which is our aspiration.
When you approach something, a work of art, something that you've never seen before, you're looking at it for the first time, do you have any hesitance, or can you, if you have a really almost visceral kind of negative reaction, do you have any problem with saying, this is horrible, I hate this, it's terrible, or do you somehow feel that you have to rein yourself in and say, well, now, wait a minute, let's just be more careful and more measured and think about it and look at it more carefully?
Well, I think that first reaction is very important, and some people will tell you it's always the right one. I actually don't think that's true, but it's always an important one, and I think it's important to accept it. But then, alas, I do believe, because maybe I just wish to be generous, that it only gets interesting when you ask yourself why you feel that way. What does it summon up in you? What is it? What do you associate it with? What troubles you about it? And the really interesting thing about art, and maybe this gets back to your original question, what is art, is that good art is the stuff that like an onion, keeps, you know, there's always another layer to it, that the longer you look, the more interesting it becomes, the less it conforms to your first impression, or anyway, the more interesting it makes your first impression. And I think it's that ability to, you know, accept your first reaction, not feel ashamed of it, or not just feel that you have to just stick with it, but pursue it. And art, you know, the beauty part of it is really that it never ends.
Yeah. Our guest is Michael Kimmelman. He is the chief art critic for the New York Times. He's also a contributor to the New York Review of Books. His book, the one that we've been talking about here this morning, is The Accidental Masterpiece on the Art of Life and Vice Versa. It's published by the Penguin Press. You can find it in the bookstore now. Mr. Kimmelman, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Pleasure for me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast in August of last year. Many past shows from Focus 580, the Afternoon Magazine, all of the local production that we do here on WILL is available on the website. That way you can listen anytime you like. You can go back and hear some shows you might have missed. Maybe there are some you might like to hear again. It's all at WILL.UIUC.edu. Programming here on the station, WILL, made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Programs here on WILL are also made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting New World Concert, 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 1st, in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information available at 333-6280. Coming up a little bit later on the Afternoon Magazine, every year millions of songbirds migrate from north to south and back again. For a cliff swallow, that journey may cover 12,000 miles. How do they do it? Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at some of the latest research on migratory songbirds. Celeste Quinn is the host, and she'll be talking with Miyoko Chu. She's an ornithologist and staff science writer at the Cornell Ornithology Lab. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. She's editor of the Cornell Ornithology Lab's Birdscape newsletter and the assistant editor of Living Bird magazine and author of a new book entitled Songbird Journeys, Four Seasons and Lives of Migratory Birds. So the program itself, Afternoon Magazine, gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Then you can hear the interview in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking about a little bit about the history of pet ownership in America. Our guest will be Catherine Greer. She's a historian at University of Delaware, has written a new book on the subject. She says, tells you some interesting things about people's attitudes, about what's important, attitudes about child raising, for example, all of that coming up in the next part of the show. So we hope you'll stay tuned. Right now, we're going to take a break. We'll have news from NPR and an update on the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM.